Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Charity Charge Show. This is your host, Stephen Garten. I'm recording a little bit of a preface here because this is an amazing interview that I had with Suzanne Stone of Livestrong. And part of the audio, I apologize to the audience and to Suzanne, got cut off as we were recording this handful of months ago, but it's an amazing episode. Wanted to give this preface. Without further ado, we'll go straight into the episode.
Basically, what it means is that I get to spend my days looking for answers and then finding funding for them and figuring out who's the best person to implement those solutions.
That's awesome. So we're chatting with Suzanne Stone from the Livestrong Foundation, who is the, now I might get it off, the Chief Strategic Solutions and Program Manager.
Officer.
I'm so sorry.
You're so close.
I was so close. I had one job and I just butchered that. But thank you. No, it's good to chat.
Yeah.
But just picking up where you were, one of the things I just kind of start this, and I probably shared on our earlier call, I always just thought in general, the whole mission, we're going to talk about, your perspectives and just what you've seen in the nonprofit space and sometimes the reasons why people should start nonprofits, the reasons a lot of times people shouldn't start nonprofits, but instead join or merge existing wonderful organizations that are, tied to whatever the mission that they're interested in impacting the world with. But I just want to bring it back first and foremost to Livestrong Foundation. My father passed away from cancer when I was 19. And as much as at the time, I just wanted there to be a cure, and it went on from when he was diagnosed to then having surgery and dealing with, chemotherapy and all of that. He lived for about 18 months, which for his type of cancer, he had ampullary cancer, which is similar in nature to pancreatic, he's passed away over 15 years ago. So there was not much hope for him to be around for a while. So 18 months actually was a long time, but at the same time, it was so agonizing because, I just wanted a cure, and I couldn't understand why there wasn't some sort of special pill that he could take. And so in that mindset, when I was like acutely dealing with it on a personal level, I was so focused on those aspects of the medicine side. But when I moved to Austin, I'd always heard of the name, like Livestrong Foundation. I knew it through just all the publicity and all of like the things that the organization has done over the years. I was really happy to hear about the services side of what you guys provide. And I know, a lot of it has revolved around how do you help the individuals dealing with it? How do you help their family? Even basic things about, there's a lot of people that have cancer that, for a variety of reasons, including financial, can't even get to the place to get their chemo treatments, So just curious if you could talk a little bit about that wrapper and that, the need for that, because we were talking about before, I could go on and on, but it's kind of interesting of like where Livestrong stepped in to do that. I just think it's such a great mission. So curious if you could just share kind of your passion for being there and what you guys are doing around those areas.
Absolutely. So Livestrong has always been an impact funder, and that's what we really are. We've kind of newly defined ourselves as an impact funder, but that's really where we enter the cancer space. So we provide, direct services are fantastic to have, and there are a lot of amazing nonprofits all across the country, and we really serve people all across the globe, but focused here in the United States. And we are always looking to make the person's quality of life better. That's what the focus is. It's not on the cure. No matter what kind of cancer you have it, right? There's no going back. You can't hit a reverse button, although that would be really nice. There's no rewind. We can't undo. And there are billions of dollars being spent every year on research for those specific types of cancer, like the kind that your dad had. And so that's not where our focus is. Our focus instead is how do we make the quality of life the best it can possibly be for those who have cancer in their journey? And that may be the person who has cancer, or the caregiver, or the physician, or their kids. So there's lots of people, as you know, that are impacted when somebody gets cancer. That is not one person's journey. It expounds, right? It's a coworker. It's now what do I do? So if I have a coworker that gets diagnosed, that impacts me and my job and all kinds of things. So that circle of impact is really large. And that's why you will be very hard pressed to find anybody over the age of 15 who doesn't know somebody with cancer, mm-hmm. because it has impacted their lives. So we're really looking to solve problems that are really every day. And they sound pretty simple, but as somebody who's been through this, you know it's not. So things like, I don't remember what the doctor said, mm-hmm. you know? Sure. I don't know how to tell my kids, or I can't afford to go to my doctor's appointments. Basic things like that. Or I have lymphedema that's debilitating. I'm done with my cancer journey, right? So we call it post-treatment care. I'm done with this journey, but now I have all these side effects and I don't know how to deal with these. You know, I won my, I know you can't see it, but I'm using my air quotes, you know, I've won the war. I've won the battle, but now I have all this, you know, this PTSD and this other stuff. And so at Livestrong, we're really looking to fix those things. And what we found over the years is that we are experts in lots of things. We're experts in collaboration. We're really expert in listening, not just hearing, but really listening and then responding to what we're hearing from the community and from the cancer community and finding solutions. What we also know is we couldn't possibly have a staff big enough to deliver all of those solutions. So instead, what we do is we go out and we find people, nonprofit organizations, for-profit organizations, other partners out in the world who are really good at delivering this solution. And we invest in them, and we take those donor dollars and we say, hey, we have found a great solution, and we're gonna take your money and we're gonna invest it strategically into a solution that's going to impact not just six people, right? But maybe that's at first, or maybe it's a small group at first, but it's something that we can invest in that will make quality of life better. And that it has the potential to scale to impact hopefully hundreds of thousands of people.
That's inspiring. I want to ask you on that, you know, something that's come up, Suzanne, that I've been thinking a lot about is, first of all, for frame of reference, how long have you been with Livestrong?
So I've been with Livestrong for 6 months. Okay. I've been in the nonprofit field for 25 years.
Yep.
So much like an accountant, you know, this is what I do for a living.
Sure. So some of this you'll be able to I think it's a great perspective, because you'll be able to comment on from an external perspective and now an internal perspective. One of the things, I mean, certainly, you know, nonprofit organizations are always focused on is fundraising and also where the source of those funds is going to originate from. Individuals, corporations, grants, partnership programs, CSR, et cetera. When I think back about, you know, Livestrong, obviously I got to know it through all the partnerships that you had with Lance Armstrong, with Nike, and all the other kind of revenue that I'm sure that brought in. So I think it also applies, it's a really relevant point right now, because I think that a lot of nonprofits are struggling, you know, with fundraising and maybe have one channel or one or multiple sources that are down and they're trying to refocus. Just can you give me your perspective of how Livestrong has navigated that over the years? Because I think for a lot of organizations, if you lost what sort of, in a sense, Livestrong lost, they would just be out of business. But I would think that there was clearly certain level of financial commitment from the board or others that you all were able to rally through it and obviously continue your mission. So curious, like, to the extent you can comment that on an external and internal, and what other advice you kind of think that gives for those operating nonprofits today.
Absolutely. So I could write a book on that question you just asked.
Good. Please do.
So from an overarching nonprofit perspective, when you put everybody in general, so I'm gonna quote a statistic here, and there'll be people who are listening that are nonprofit executives saying that's not right for me. And while I know that this may not be true for everybody, it is in general. So 91% of all revenue for all nonprofits in the United States is coming from individual donors. 91%. This is a really important number because it shows the lack of diversity in economy, right? Where is that revenue coming from? Just like in any regular for-profit business, if you only have one primary stream of income, which is like what we're seeing right now, right? Those businesses that are able to shift quickly and have diversified areas of income, they figured out, okay, well, if I'm a restaurant, for example, I need to make sure that I'm only 48% of my income is alcohol. Otherwise, they're going to shut me down because I'm a bar. So I need to have other revenue streams besides just this. And we need to have, maybe you see people starting to sell groceries out of the restaurant.
Sure.
Right? So they're diversifying. So it's the same thing with nonprofits. It's exactly the same thing. But 91% are relying, or 91% of all income that's coming in is from individual donors. So we're bound to the economy, married to it. So if the economy is bad and the individual donor doesn't have discretionary dollars to use, then you can imagine that our revenue is going to be down. It gets very hard to ask people for help in a time of crisis because we're not going to, you know, people still have to eat, right? Grocery stores will be fine. Restaurants would be fine too. Hurricanes hit, we have natural disasters, things that are short term. From a nonprofit side, that is not the case. So let's take Hurricane Harvey as an example. Hurricane Harvey hits Houston. Mm-hmm. Businesses go under, you know, people lose their houses, but the businesses recover because it's just infrastructure that they lost. And it's temporary, it's very short term. From a nonprofit side, now we have to go and ask all of those people who've just lost their homes and they're in a tough place in their business for money to sustain us. Oh, that's really tough. So it's a huge challenge when you are faced with a crisis of proportions like the one that we're facing today. From a LiveStrong perspective, what you saw in our early years were connections that we made through what we call in the nonprofit field, cause-related marketing. And it's in the marketing field too. So it is where you have a company that is for profit that is aligning themselves with a philanthropic endeavor. And in doing that, they're capitalizing on the brand and on customer loyalty or, you know, individual loyalty, and they're making money too, right? So they're gonna align their brands. And that's what you saw with companies like Nike and Oakley and many, many others, Shimano, it's a very long list of companies that partnered with us. And they wanted to capitalize on the success and the celebrity of our founder. And so that was fantastic for us as a foundation. We were able to help so many people and do such incredible work with the revenue that we were able to receive from those cause-related marketing agreements. What the board did at that time and has continued to do is we made a conscious decision, the board here made a conscious decision that said, we're going to take this money and while we're going to invest a lot of it into the communities, right, into solving these everyday practical problems that cancer survivors and caregivers and patients and warriors have, we're also going to be fiscally responsible and we're going to plan. And that's something that a lot of nonprofits that we see don't do. So what we did is we were able to, because of the success of our of those cause-related marketing campaigns and because of the generosity of these individual donors that we have at the time, we were able to put away more than 6 months of operating expense. I know that today the Nonprofit Finance Fund will tell you that less than 25% of nonprofits in the country have 6 months or more in reserve. So that was back in 2017 when they did that survey. If you've only got 6 months, we're almost 6 months into this.
Sure.
And that means that you've got most nonprofits are almost out of money because everybody else was less than six. So you've got a lot of nonprofits laying people off, closing their doors, shutting down operations altogether, when in fact, this is the time more than ever that we need them.
Absolutely. Because
where government stops is where nonprofits start. And wow, that's the real crisis, in my opinion, that we're having here. From a LiveStrong perspective and some of our other larger partners, we've been fortunate enough to have early success to be able to put money away.
Yep.
But if you didn't do that, whether you're a for-profit or a nonprofit, honestly, if you were not managing your money and explain to your donors why you need that fund, then you're in trouble.
With that said, I mean, you were talking about the strategic and insight that the board had. When I see organizations that don't have, for example, the 6 months of runway, and a lot of organizations, you know, that we work with directly or just indirectly are part of our community, have gone out of business or were just under immense stress and strain almost immediately. Like, and you saw a lot of for-profit companies having that same issue where they didn't have the 6 months or more. When we think about the nonprofit world, kind of focusing and you thinking about your experience with having different, working at different organizations and different board members, from my opinion, this falls squarely, if I'm going to point the finger, at the board. You know, and I wonder how these organizations candidly just lacked a strong board that knew any better. And part of it, I say that knew any better because it really doesn't take very much to file paperwork and start a nonprofit. I mean, if you want to do it, you can do it. And you can recruit a board to do that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the people that are joining your board actually have experience operating and managing a nonprofit. So curious for you to talk about the role of the board and also just general advice, because I think almost every day someone's asked to join a board, but what does that even mean?
Absolutely. So the board is incredibly, the board is ultimately fiscally responsible for the health of the organization. They are.
That's key. I think that is so overlooked.
Mm-hmm. They are responsible.
Yep.
So I come and go, right? Executive directors come and go. CEOs come and go from nonprofits, and the board is still there. So when you are leading a nonprofit, let's say you're sitting in a role like I've had, right? So as executive director, I would have, what my biggest board was 22. I had 22 bosses, right? I was like, this is crazy. Talk about herding cats, right? Really tough. But so you have all of these people on the board, and there really needs to be some conversation early on. So let's say you started a nonprofit, and we can talk about whether or not you should start one in a second, but let's just say that you did it. Most of the time, nonprofits are started out of something that there is a catalyst, right? There's a tragic act, there's a tragedy that occurs, there's an experience that happens, there is something that happens to a person, and that person is dealing with their grief or anxiety or whatever that emotion is, by feeling like they need to do something. They need to take action. So those people who feel that way often say, I'm going to start a nonprofit so that nobody ever has to feel what I've felt. Nobody ever has to experience what I've experienced. Unfortunately, what that means is that we have, unfortunately, kind of the hubris of humans. We believe that nobody else has possibly felt or gone through the things that we're going through. Yeah, you may have lost your dad to cancer, but not the way I lost my dad to cancer. It was a totally different experience, even though the reality it was very same, very similar, even though the diagnosis may be different and you lived in a different state. And so anyway, so I
don't know why this should be or would be controversial at all, but what you're saying, I'm just 100% in agreement with.
Thank you.
I get
rocks thrown at me sometimes, but that's okay. You know, right. It's okay. And I'm not saying that I'm right. This is my opinion on kind of the state of nonprofit, having been in it for so long. And I've witnessed people who are so passionate. They're so passionate. And that's what we need, right? We need really passionate people to lead these efforts. So what happens is, as I'm a founder, if I'm a founder of a nonprofit and I say, okay, I'm starting a nonprofit and I'm gonna save animals. And I'm gonna use this example I use on occasion. So I rescued a dog from the side of the road. He was hit by a car. I took him to the vet. I paid all the bills. And then I decided, oh my gosh, I need to create a rescue. And I'm going to name it after the dog, you know, Archie's Fund. I'm making this up. I don't know if there is one or not, but Archie's Rescue. Yeah. And so I'm creating Archie's Rescue. And then I recruit a bunch of my friends to be board members. I do that because in order to file a 501c3 application with the IRS, you have to have a board. And you have to report that board. So that board is reportable, and the IRS knows who you are. So that's when we talk about being fiscally responsible. Like, you legitimately are fiscally responsible for that organization. So what happens is, I put a bunch of my friends on the board. Well, they're my friends. And so, or they may be my family members. That's also something we see a lot. And that's trouble, because it is highly unlikely that your family and friends are made up of an attorney, a marketing expert, somebody that's a couple of experts in the field in which you are in philanthropy. So maybe some dog, you know, a couple of veterinarians, maybe somebody that owns a pet store. You know, you need somebody who understands HR. Maybe you need commercial realty. Like, you need to put people on the board who are diverse, not only should they reflect the community that you're serving. So if you live in Austin, your board should look ethnically and culturally, should look like the town in which you are existing, should look like that. But it also needs to be diverse in areas of expertise. If you put all venture capitalists on your board, that's great. You're going to have great finances, but, you know, HR is going to be out the window, and you need that really great balance. So if you are starting a nonprofit, or if you have one right now, you really need to be very cognizant of what that board looks like. If you're sitting on a board now, you need to really look at the diversity of your board. And if somebody says to you, hey, like I had an offer the other day, hey, Suzanne, we'd love for you to come join the board. I said, sure, tell me what gap am I filling? It's important for me as a board member to understand what gap am I filling. And if you can't answer that question, then I need you to look back on the board. What gap am I filling of expertise? So that's something that's super important. When we hear all of these, you know, these some of your clients and people that you've been working with, and they went under, right? They had no runway whatsoever. And it is definitely ultimately the responsibility of the board and however many executive directors that they've gone through in the past. But what unfortunately is saddling nonprofits, and so I'm going to give them a little bit of a pass. We have to give them a little bit of a break, because if you're not in nonprofit and you're just a donor to nonprofit, you say, and I hear it all the time and have for decades, I'm going to give you my dollar that I worked really hard for, but you better spend it on the peanut butter and jelly sandwich. You are not allowed to have, you cannot spend it on salary. That means I don't care if you get paid. You have to find somebody else to pay your salary. So you can't pay it on your salary. You also can't pay it on any overhead. So that computer you need, I don't care how you pay for it, but you're not going to pay for it with my money. I want my money to go buy the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And so we have donors who restrict what we can spend money on, and they are very, they're unforgiving with how much we're able to spend. So, and that spend is on, and I use peanut butter and jelly because I think we all know what that is, right? What do you need for a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? It's really simple. I've got to have bread, peanut butter, and jelly, but I have to have a refrigerator for the jelly and maybe for the bread too, in case it goes bad. Then I have to have something to wrap it in. So, and then I've got to, because I have to deliver it. So I have to have a delivery system in place. Who's delivering it? I've got to put people there. Are those people, we'll just get volunteers. Who's going to manage those volunteers and coordinate them? Another volunteer? When are they doing that? And they can't do that fast because nobody can take that much time off work. Anyway, it's a snowball effect, right? So when we talk about having that rainy day fund or the runway fund, to be fiscally responsible, donors don't like it when we show them our not we at LiveStrong, I'm saying we collectively as nonprofit organizations in general, they don't like it when we show them our financials and they see the runway, right? They see that rainy day fund. What they should be saying, in my opinion, and of course I'm biased because I sit here, but I'm not biased because we sit here and I'm a part of this organization because we're fiscally responsible. Not only are we here, we're hiring. We've hired 3 people since COVID started. We're not shrinking, we're hiring. And that's testament to the fact that we had board members and we have constituents who understand that in order for us to be here tomorrow and in 6 months and in 2 years to continue to do the work that we need, we have to invest in ourselves. We have to invest in the smartest people we can hire, in the infrastructure we need to have a computer and a camera to get stuff done on Zoom. And then we also have to invest in that savings, in that conservative business savings account that every for-profit should be doing as well.
What, you know, it's actually so funny that we're talking about this because it's kind of, and I love them, although we work with a bunch of MasterCard and a bunch of, and Commerce Bank and some other partners. I have literally right here paperwork I have to drop off. I don't know if there's really anything confidential on here, but anyway, it's a savings and it's an additional checking account that I'm just creating to park extra cash and purposely keep it separated from our, you know, our operating account. And I'll be candid, it's the first time we've been operational and earning revenue since June of 2016. And we have very simple, cash in, cash out, sources, so to speak. But just with everything that's going on and having conversations like this, I just want to have a separate account. First and foremost, just like line item, when I log in, I could just see that, hey, that cash is there and I'm not touching, I'm not pulling from it. So, you know, we're doing it as a for-profit, but.
Yeah. And it makes so much common sense. And so it's really interesting, right? That for whatever reason, it's not common sense. It's, or that from in the nonprofit sector, it's frowned upon to be so bold as to say, mm-hmm. I'm going to save money. I'm not going to spend money. And I think as long as we as nonprofits have to do a really good job of explaining to our donors what we're doing and why we're doing it. And I think that when we do that, most people will say, oh, well, I guess that does make sense. We want you to be, we want you to be in business for a decade. I want my investment to go on and on. Like today, I had somebody come to my house and there's an electric gate that opens and shuts on in front of the house. Mm-hmm. And it got stuck. And so it's a house that I'm renting. So I don't own this house, right? So the guy comes out and he looks at the gate and he says, hey, you're gonna need a new electric board or whatever. And it's gonna be $3,600. And so I told my landlord it was gonna be $3,600. And she was like, what, $3,600 is so much. And I was like, you're investing.
Yeah.
You want the gate to be here, right? Like long-term. So you invest in that. And so after I talked her off the cliff and explained, the warranty and all that, she's like, oh, I guess that doesn't seem so bad. no, it doesn't seem so bad. You know, we want our investments to last. We want the roof that we put on our house to last.
Well, to one way, I appreciate everything that you've talked about, which makes a lot of sense right now if you've started a nonprofit, if you're starting a new nonprofit, you've put together some practical ways to be financial savvy, ways to recruit the right board members, what to you know, ask of them for the respective roles, the gaps they fill, and then how to be financially prudent. But what about organizations right now that are really struggling, that maybe look at it and have either debts or, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 weeks of run room? You talk about any of your experience or just, and also advice of just merging or partnering or shutting down. Yeah. And I'm curious a little bit to the reminder maybe I would just put out about what was the purpose and the intention of your organization as a whole. I think that a lot of times, as you alluded to, organizations are started by a personal experience. And I see that all the time with founders of organizations that I'm working with. And I think they can get caught up sometimes in that own story and that own personal reason. But if the purpose of the organization was to remove or, you know, help those animals or make sure no one ever felt the way you did when your parent died of cancer or whatever it might be, there's likely a lot of other organizations doing that. So can you put the ego aside and figure out how to take your resources to them?
Right. Absolutely. So, you know, kind of back to that dog example, Archie's Fund, there are today in the United States.
By the way, I'm sure, I know you made that up. There's absolutely got to be an Archie's
Fund. I know, right?
Out there.
Believe me, that's awesome. You got to Google it now. Right?
Yeah. When we first launched and it was just the consumer card, we partnered with GuideStar. So we pulled basically the entire nonprofit database into our platform. So we would have every day, it was like, I realized there's just a nonprofit for everything because people were coming on the site from all over the country, mm-hmm. searching by name, finding their organization. Yep. It's just, it's unreal.
It is. It is. So there are 27,000 nonprofits in the United States that list dog rescue as what they do. 27,000. We don't need 27,000 dog rescues. I mean, we need some dog rescues, don't get me wrong, but I just don't know that we need 27,000 of them, because that's 27,000 CEOs,
yeah,
and laptops and webcams and all that overhead, right? That everybody complains about. In Austin, we have 7,500 nonprofits in Austin. That's crazy. So we are still waiting, of course, to see how this all pans out.
Sure.
But if you are a nonprofit now, and we have relationships with hundreds, literally here at Live Strong, that I talk to almost daily. I don't talk to hundreds daily, but there are hundreds of them, and many of them I talk to every day, that we partner with and collaborate with. We have several who have just stopped their programming. So it, because now their programming is completely impossible. They can't do in-person trips to go fly fishing, right? Can't do that. You can't do exercise programs. Live Strong at the Y. Oh, you can't do that right now. So there's all of these, so some people have chosen one, they've had to close, right? They had nothing left. This is what I would suggest. If it were me, if I were in the situation where I had 6 months of runway, let's just say, because I'm going to hope that I would be leading an organization that was smart and had some money. But let's just say this is it, right? Because it's not, this is tough. This is really tough right now. And we're coming up on the end of 6 months. We're coming up on 6 months and the writing is on the wall. What do we do? I would actively look to all of the people that I've partnered with in the past. We as nonprofits, just like you, you know, just like you and what you do, you are part of a network. There are networks everywhere. It doesn't have to be a nonprofit, another nonprofit that does exactly what you do. I would look for nonprofits that enhance what you do, right? That it's like the color wheel. So I wouldn't look for all the reds. I would look for all the other colors too.
What might be an example for Archie's fund that's
helpful? Sure. So for Archie's fund, I might say, okay, so if you're focused on rescuing dogs, what if you found a partner that does direct financial support to people who can't afford to get their dogs vaccinated? And then you also partnered with somebody that does free spay and neutering. And then a couple of different shelters, one that focus, you know, and maybe some rescue ranches where you've got those dogs that bite and that can't go anywhere else. Mm-hmm. So those would be an example.
Yeah, that's great.
And then you all come together collaboratively into a unit, at least temporarily, and say, okay, we can, all of us need to, you know, we are serving the same constituency. People who give, if I love dogs, okay, I believe people give to one of three things. Everybody. You're either a plant, you're a person, or you're an animal. And that's it. So this is Suzanne's theory of giving. So if I have discretionary income and I only could give to one cause, whatever your answer is, that's who you are. So if your answer is, oh, I would give to education for kids, then you're a people. If the answer is, I would give to save the whales, then you're an animal. If your answer is, I want to stop climate change, then you're a plant. So from an Archie's Fund example, you are all of you collaboratively are already asking the very same people for money. I would bet you that the same people who go to your gala, go to his gala, go to her gala, that donate to his thing, right? They're the same people, especially if they're in the same town or this, you know, the same community. So if you get all, this is what I would do with Archie's Fund is I would build my color wheel. I'd build my collaborative wheel of what this could look like. And then we collectively take all of our donors together. Just take a deep breath and hear me out. Take all of your donors together and say, this is what we're going to do. Dogs still need us. These are the services we can provide. Keep helping us because people are losing their houses and people don't have enough money to pay for dog food anymore, but we're still here and we're working together to make sure that no dog is left behind. I'm making this up, obviously, off the top of my head. But then me as a donor, I'm looking at this and going, my dollar's really gonna do a lot more. My dollar can really impact. We can also consolidate our systems. We don't need, you know, let's pick one person to run the show, right? One person maybe has that deciding factor, but we get rid of all the offices. Let's let all the leases go. And one person has a copier. So let's all use that copier as the printer, the scanner, right? We don't need five. Let's just use one. Now suddenly we're reducing expense. So that's an example of how you can do it. Not only does it reduce expense, but it increases impact. That's even better. And you become this new sustainable organization because you're not competing with people who are asking the same people for the same dollars. Does that make sense? That's how I would do it.
That's how it really does. I mean, in unpacking it a bit, number one, I got to think about it more because I was trying to poke holes in when you said it was a human, an animal, or a plant. I'm trying to figure out if there's a fourth or fifth, but I'll have to do that on my own time. I think that the color wheel example was awesome, actually, how you rounded that out. Because in my mind, when you first said it, I thought, oh, well, you'll just partner with the cats, not like you're doing dogs, they're doing. But I appreciate how you're actually still focused on that area of like some people, like, candidly, are way more passionate. They're like, are you a dog person or a cat person? So, you know, you can round out the other services to help dogs, you know, in that case. You know, and then it made me think about even locally here. I mean, you might be more familiar to help fill in the gaps for me here. But I think about, you know, we've got a Austin Pets Alive, but then we also have an Emancipet, then we also have I'm just thinking of the other like collaborative, you know.
Yeah,
so what is If we unpack that, then we're talking about it right now in terms of, hey, it's dire. Like, what are we going to do here to survive? Is it ego? Like, why is there just not more of this going on? Because it really just seems like the world would be a better place and capital would be spent much more effectively if we had massive consolidation in the nonprofit space.
I agree. It is. A lot of it is, you know, ego is a great thing. It's not a bad thing. But it is something that is a barrier to success in a lot of ways. We talk in the nonprofit sector about something we call founder syndrome. And that's a real thing. It is when you have a founder of a nonprofit who is now needs, you know, they brought in all the people, the nonprofit has grown, and they're unwilling to relinquish control. And because it's their baby, right? It's their child. And so,
100%. I mean, I know that as well as can be, you know, just with what we've done.
Yeah.
You know, here, just starting Charity Church and growing it.
Yeah, you don't want to let this go, right? You've done all this hard work and you don't want to let it go and you think that nobody will be able to run it as good as you.
Right.
Which is
so wrong. I've, you know, now see that and been proven so wrong. One of the things though, that there's so many things though, when you are the founder, you know, if it's that stereotypical story of you started it, so you did everything and then slowly you were able to grow enough and kind of hire on people. What I've realized over time, and this has come out through multiple conversations, one most recently, one of our newest nonprofits we're working with is the Replenish Foundation. Their model is really, really cool. I'll have to send you their link. But anyway, I was chatting with their founder, Ron, actually on the podcast. And one of the things that he brought up, which the way he worded it or just said it was so done so well, is really that you're robbing other people of the things that they would really enjoy. So for example, there's all the operational things I hate doing, but Abby, who does those things for us, loves doing them. So not only, you know, by ceding that to her, she's actually enjoys her life. Like, she enjoys her job and it's great. And it was something that I hated, but forever, a lot of those things I didn't want to let go of.
Yeah. You know, control is something that we're definitely not very good. Most people are very, controlling at different levels, right? Yeah. And especially people that have that entrepreneurial bent.
Yeah.
So if you've started something, you can call yourself an entrepreneur. I call myself a serial nonprofit entrepreneur, not because I've ever started a nonprofit, but because I like to come into nonprofits and work with systems change and work to not necessarily reinvent, because that's not the right word. That would be negative in any of the organizations I work for. That's not the case. But instead, kind of tweak and fine-tune and look for places where we can do better. This is my passion. I love to scale. That's what I love to do. And founders often hold organizations back from excelling. Kind of go back to that, you know, when we were talking about why you start a nonprofit. And the lack of diversity that can happen in those very first boards that are so crucial to those beginning years of any business also goes back to the experience of what experience does the founder have? If you're an architect, what experience do you have in saving dogs or running a business?
Right.
Have you ever filled out, have you ever done payroll? Did you, you know, have you ever negotiated a lease agreement? Are you, you know, do you know what CRM is? Do you know the tax laws around what you can and cannot take? What about, you know, most of the time people who begin nonprofits are not nonprofit people. That they're not. That would be like me deciding on a Tuesday that you know what? I just watched this guy fix the gate and I'm like, I'm it. I want to be an electrical engineer. And I'm going to go and I go tomorrow and I start my own electrical engineering firm. I could, but I don't have any idea what I'm doing. Like that would be insanity. Why would we do that? But that's what happens in the nonprofit world every single
day. Yeah, 100%. Well, you know, and it's human nature, because I think it's a little bit more, people are more, have like, what would you call it? Like a kind of a twinkle in their eyes. Like they're willing to just kind of jump in sometimes even more naively on the nonprofit side, starting that. But that's what happens every day on the for-profit.
Every day.
You know, people decide to start businesses that they have literally zero domain expertise in, you know? And it's crazy because we get, I get people that reach out to me a lot that are starting some sort of, and look, I mean, our focus right now, I mean, and seemingly will just continue to be, is just essentially banking services and financial services for nonprofits, that more kind of B2B play. But we started out with just our consumer card product, where, you know, there's a lot of these different products out there that are meant to enhance, you know, fundraising for nonprofits and be an easier way for people to be able to give back. So I have people that are starting those types of companies, or this app that helps people give even easier to nonprofits. Yeah. And I'm like, what experience do you have? You know, you could just see through it that there's just no insight.
I think, you know, the best place for a founder, in my experience, is once the business has grown to a point that it's running on its own, it's time for the founder to move to the board and be on the board. It doesn't, you know, empower a nonprofit professional, just like you would hire an accountant, just like you would hire an electrician. Mm-hmm. Hire somebody who knows what they're doing and let them take your vision to a whole level you couldn't have even imagined, because that's what will happen, you know?
Sure. And then, I'm going through that right now, just with what we're doing. I mean, in a little bit of a different way, but we're going to be rolling out a few new products that'll enhance just our offering. I mean, I'm essentially turning this into a bank for nonprofits. So there's naturally other products and things we will be offering. And where I'm having the most fun is coming up with the new product, and I'm working on getting those stood up, but I'm not going to do a whole lot after those are created, other than figure out like what's the next thing to create here and just keep growing the ecosystem that we have.
And that's the great thing about being the founder, right? So whether you're a founder of a nonprofit or a for-profit, when you're that person that has that vision, the best thing that you can do as a leader, right, is to put people around you that are smarter than you in all of those areas that you need support in. So I know where my gaps are. Everybody should know where their gaps are. You know, I feel like you have to be self-aware enough to know where your gaps are. So know where those gaps are. And then as a founder from a nonprofit side, say, I'm going to find the best executive director or CEO or whatever you want to call the person that I possibly can, who understands how to run a nonprofit. And then I'm going to move to the board, or I'm going to move to an advisory level, but I would suggest a board role initially, at least. And because you're their boss, you know, you're still there. But you are surrounding yourself with people who have more experience perhaps than you do, or deeper experience than you do on how to do this. Your vision won't go away. It will only grow tenfold when you let go. And you know, I had a boss, one of my very first bosses, would not tell anybody anything that was ever happening. And his philosophy was, if you know, you have power. And where he was wrong, so he was right in yes, knowledge is power. But what he was wrong in is that by not sharing that knowledge, he was actually taking his own power away. And when you share knowledge with others, you are empowering them to do amazing things. And that... His company has not done well because of that. I have to be like this. I have to be like this. And you cannot grow when you are wound that tight, you know? You just, if you empower others with your vision, they won't let you down.
Well, I think, and I would argue or just add to it that I think it's empowering with the vision, but I also think it's being honest with the reality of what's happening, right? So every organization, I don't care if you had the 6 months in the bank, it was like getting punched in the face or punched in the gut, you know, in March and maybe even there on out, right? So, I mean, we dealt with that as well too. And so, you know, I was extremely straightforward with our small team of where we're at, what revenue looks like, cash flow, you know, all these things. And we had, like a lot of organizations, grander plans for right now of where we would be, some of the other things that we would be doing that would have increased expenses, but we, you know, realized that we need to be more conservative because we've got ways to go economically before we're through this. And at the end of the day, our business is allowing nonprofits to spend. Well, there's less money nonprofits are spending. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, like, it's going to affect us. But in sharing that brutal reality, my small team rallied around it, you know, in a lot of different ways. You know, one of the gentlemen who's been with us for a while, who's is in a, you know, marketing, like independent contractor type of role, basically just said, we had a few invoices that we owed. He said, don't pay me any of those. Instead, let's flip it. I'm just going to work the next 6 months. We'll break those out. That was incredible. Two of my other people, you know, that were going to get raises said, we're good. Like, we just want to stay here and move forward. We want Charity Charge to be stable. And that never would have happened had I just not been brutally honest with them.
Right. You know? And that's that control piece.
Yeah.
So when you share, knowledge is power, but you have to share the knowledge to empower people. And by sharing that information, you empowered your staff to make their own choices. And lo and behold, they chose you. And that's loyalty. And that is what I think from a founder perspective, that sometimes you get a little bit of tunnel vision. And we see that all the time. I know you see it too. You get the tunnel vision, but if you can trust, which is really hard, you know, therapists make a lot of money on this issue alone. But if you can trust, then I think that your organization and your vision will grow because of it. Today, you have this, I think nonprofits have this really unique opportunity. I don't look at it as a bad thing. It is really hard to watch nonprofits close. Very hard. I don't like it. It's ugly and it hurts almost physically, right? Because you understand what goes in behind it. You understand the heart, the sweat, and the tears and the long hours and the nobody gets paid what they're worth. No one. And we work arguably twice as hard as people who make the same amount as we do, who sell widgets or houses or, you know, whatever. And so when you watch them go under, it's very disheartening. But I think we have an extraordinary opportunity in this time to say, we're going to collaborate. We're not going to go under. We're going to find a way to make this work. I think another option, if you are going under, so if you happen to be watching or listening and you say, well, you know, I'm out of runway, because I would say 75% of nonprofits are out. They're out of runway. And they are begging for money right now from anybody that will give them a dime. And so if you're one of those people, then what I would say is find a nonprofit. I'm just going to use Live Strong as an example. Let's say you're in the cancer care space. This is what you do, right? You provide a service for cancer patients. And you have $70,000 left in the bank. I'm just making up a number. But you've got $70,000 left, and that's it. And there's no fundraising in sight. Your events have all been canceled. You got nothing. So $70,000 isn't going to sustain you because you've got 4 employees. You're done, right? Writing's on the wall. So what are you going to do with this $70,000? You could divide it up among the employees and call it a day and shut the door. Or you could say to your donors, we're going to invest it with LiveStrong, let's just say. And so for us, we have solution grants. And so let's say that organization came to us and say, we want to fund a grant through you to help that focuses on everybody who has blue eyes that gets cancer. I'm again making it up. And so we say, sure, we'd love to. So we take your $70,000. We do all the hard work. We do all the administrative stuff. You don't have to do anything other than the fact that you can talk about it with your donors. And now maybe you're raising money for a fund and you have one employee.
Yep.
And you're using us as a conduit to fund, to continue the work that you were doing just in a different way. Right. So you don't lose those contacts. You don't.
Look, I think that this is really relevant. I know you're giving it just as the example, but there are plenty of organizations out there in the scope of, you know, four persons and focused on cancer. And this might be a really relevant thing as you've talked about your, you know, LiveStrong itself's, you know, financial stability and what you guys are doing. So I'm curious on that end, just people listening, how would individuals get involved in that way or learn more?
Sure, absolutely. Well, just call me.
We didn't plan this, by the way, but it's a good segment. Yeah.
No, you know, I think just call me. Call me, shoot me an email. I think that that's the best way. My perspective on everything that I do is that somebody wrote a rule book somewhere, but I didn't read it. So I'm an early adopter. If you tell me there's water and I am underneath that bridge and I've seen some data that proves that there is, I'll jump even if I can't see it myself. I believe in the goodness of people. I am an eternal optimist. And so what that means from a business sense is that if you call me and say, this is where we are, help. How could we partner together? How can we create impact? Again, that's my passion. At LiveStrong, we are uniquely positioned to deliver impact at a really big scale. That's something that very few organizations are positioned to do. I'm so fortunate to be able to work here and do that thing. So if you are, if you happen to be an organization that does some, you know, provide some sort of a direct service to cancer patients, survivors, caregivers, whoever that is on that spectrum, and you're at a runway, absolutely call me and let's see what we can do. I don't want to erase your organization because I don't think that that's the other thing, right? Don't erase your organization. Don't erase what's been done, but instead let's scale that impact that you're having.
Oh, can you say out your email?
Absolutely. So my email is really simple. It's Suzanne, S-U-Z-A-N-N-E dot stone, like a rock, S-T-O-N-E, at livestrong.org. So pretty simple. You can also jump up on our website, livestrong.org. And if you go to our team, you'll find me there. You can also track me down on LinkedIn. You can find me there also. So I make lots of friends up in the blue square.
Love it. I want to, in closing here also, I'm starting to do this more because, you know, we initially connected, one, through a connector, our mutual friend, Mitch Jacobson, had put us in touch. And, you know, our whole mission is to make sure that organizations and the people running them are not in any way involving their personal finances. So, you know, our main product is our card, where the biggest aspect of it is no personal credit check, no personal guarantee. I'm just curious. I mean, I know I didn't necessarily say to you that I was going to bring this up in this way, but what's your just perspective on this aspect of what we're doing, but also just broadly commingling of finances and liability within nonprofits?
Yeah. There's a whole lot of commingling happening. You know, when you're the executive director or CEO, you're signing your name on all of these documents. They're all legal financial documents. You are liable for all of those things. You cannot open a bank account without a personal signer. Well, guess what? They run your credit. And And if you as an executive director, CEO have lousy credit, that's not going to work out well. If you are part of an organization that goes down or gets behind on their bills, guess who that's connected to? So your credit can be directly connected to the success of that nonprofit that you're a part of because of the way the banking industry is. I love bankers, but there could be some change there. There has to be some personal responsibility. That's when we go back to the board. It's really important that the board understand that if the executive director will be signing a lot of that paperwork, but so will the president. And ultimately in the bylaws, it will state that it's the board that has fiduciary responsibility over what happens, and they better be looking. They should be looking. If you as board members are not looking at those finances every single month, you need to start this month. Promise yourselves. Do not let another month go by without looking at the budget and understanding what it says and where that money's going. You're not being mean. You need to understand. Personal liability for business is very tough. And it's something that we deal with in nonprofit every single day. It goes, you know, it's kind of like teachers, you know. Teachers spend a lot of their own money to decorate their classrooms. We in nonprofit, we spend a lot of our own money and actually put our identities out there as leaders to in order for us to be functioning businesses. I don't like it. Never really been a big fan of, you know, putting my social security number on business transactions and documents that are related to banking or credit cards or anything that have to do with the nonprofit that, you know, I've been a part of or running. I've never liked that aspect, but there isn't an option. So what do you do? I think until the banking industry figures out another way to hold somebody accountable, because that's what they want. They want to be able to hold somebody accountable.
That's exactly where we're stepping in with our business credit card. We don't require a personal credit check. We don't require personal guarantees. We just have a different philosophy, mission, and underlying lending criteria.
Yeah, and that's a great thing. And that's what, you know, that's what you really need to look at. Most nonprofits, substantial number of, as a nonprofit, if your revenues aren't hitting $1 million a year, then you're small and you probably don't have runway and you probably don't have a lot of things. Once you hit that $1 million mark, that's kind of that marker, right? Of, okay, I can take a breath now for a second. We've got some substance underneath us, but the majority of nonprofits are not hitting $1 million. In fact, only 2% of nonprofits in Austin have revenues that are over $1 million. Yep. And remember, there's 7,500 of those. So most of them are going to be able to use services like what you're talking about, and they're going to be for people shops. And it's really important that, you know, you really pay attention to your personal liability and your personal responsibility when you're signing things like that.
Well said. I'm in a complete, you know, agreement with it. I honestly just wish someone had created this before we did. You know, it's crazy that in 2020, how non-optimized banking is with the rules and regulations and best practices of the nonprofit industry.
Yeah.
So we're just trying to figure out ways to merge those. And we'll be having some new products coming out in the near future that help even further close that gap.
That's great. You found a niche.
Well, thank you. We just found a way to try to make a difference. So it's our niche, though. We're happy to have it. Thank you so much, Suzanne, for having this conversation. Really appreciate you being on the show, the podcast, and more importantly, a friend.
Absolutely. Stephen, thanks for having me. It's always fun to talk nonprofit business.
I love it. We're going to wrap up here today. Thank you to everyone who continues to listen along to the podcast.